This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in today's show, we'll take a look at Red Bike, which recently expanded its service into northern Kentucky. First up this afternoon, since its discovery in 1739, Big Bone Lick in Boone County has drawn the attention of naturalists and paleontologists from around the world. The first organized paleontological excavation in North America was conducted there in 1807. The Cincinnati Museum Center, the Friends of Big Bone, and the Big Bone Lick Historic Site are currently working to revitalize the park's visitor center to better tell the story of the birthplace of American paleontology, located just 25 miles from downtown Cincinnati. And joining us from the Cincinnati Museum Center to discuss the revitalization project and the significance of the Big Bone Lick State Historical Site are paleontologist Dr. Brenda Hunda, curator of invertebrate paleontology, Sarah Lima, exhibits business development manager, and Big Bone Lick park interpreter Osana Wolf. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good to see everybody this afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Brenda, tell us how Big Bone Lick was formed. This was way back in the Ice Age, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's actually a really super long geologic history, even before the Ice Age, from a marine ocean that once used to cover most of North America, which formed the bedrock that we see in the Cincinnati area. Faulting and uplift of that bedrock resulted in cracks, which helped bring salt springs and sulfurous mineral waters into the region. This area in the Pleistocene would have been about a 2 mile thick ice sheet, would have been a very spruce tundra type environment, which animals would have come to Big Bone Lick.
Now, what would Big Bone Lick have looked like during this period of time? Osana?
I'll go ahead and answer that. Yeah. It would have looked very, very different from what the park looks like today, or even what it looked like at time of contact in sort of that early 1700s period. Today we see a lot of deciduous trees. We have a oak hickory forest. We do still have some remnants from the end of the last ice age or Pleistocene, like locusts. But at that time, there would have been many fewer trees, would have been much more open, significantly colder. Other than the springs and the ice sheets a couple of miles north, there wouldn't have been actually that much water. So we would have seen much less of this dense sort of mid-Atlantic rainforesty type of forest, and much more of an open area with small areas of fir, spruce, maybe some birch, even locust trees.
Osana, you're doing the interpretive text for the center. What is interpretive text? How to explain that to me?
So, I get this question a lot, actually, because I think when people hear interpreter or interpretive, they often think of interpreting languages.
Right.
And in some ways, I do that. I am the middle person between the science and the visitor. And that visitor may have no previous knowledge, or they may be a scientist themselves. So I get the fun job of trying to translate or interpret.
Put it in layman's terms?
Sort of, yeah. But okay. But at the same time, there's a really big educational component. So it's not just about communicating information. At the heart of interpretation, it's about creating a meaningful connection. So I want a visitor to come to my park. I want them to come and see our new exhibits, and I want them to feel like they can relate in some way, like the story of Big Bone is somehow relevant to them. And so often when I introduce myself, I say that it's my job to tell the story of Big Bone Lick.
And from our end at Cincinnati Museum Center, this is Sarah Lima speaking now. we've had the benefit of being able to work with Osana Wolf and with Dean Henson from Big Bone Lick State Historic Site in order to create the vision that we have for the Interpretive Center in order to meld what we know the visitors experience or typically do when they're on site and the story that we wanted to tell, especially the story that Brenda's relating of that deep geological history and how it's impacted what the park's become today.
And this is giving visitors a better idea of how significant Big Bone Lick is, correct? I mean, you're really trying to explain this much better than it's been explained in the past.
That's the goal, because the way that the visitor center was set up, it's a lovely visitor center, and it's a new building. The displays there are telling a story of the site that is kind of could be anywhere USA, or that's sort of the way that they were framed. They were telling general stories about, for example, the Ordovician period, that period that Brenda was describing where Cincinnati and much of North America was covered by ocean, telling stories about the Pleistocene era that Osana's described, where we have coniferous forests and a colder climate. But what's really amazing about Big Bone Lick is the story of its role in scientific discovery in America in the early 19th century and even the late 18th century. So that's the story that we were set up to tell so that people could walk into the site and really feel like they're standing at a place of scientific discovery.
And let's go backward a little bit more here and talk about the animals that were actually on the site. It was a diverse group of animals, wasn't it? You had a lot of different mammals and mammoths, mastodons, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was absolutely really diverse. And actually, we only really have a small window of the kind of Pleistocene animals that we would have seen there. Because most of the focus on the collecting has been done on the large megafauna, the things that people are most familiar with when they think about the Pleistocene, the mammoths, the mastodons, the giant ground sloths, the ancient horse, and the giant bisons. We do have some evidence of some smaller animals, but you'd expect to see very similar creatures like today, rabbits, marmots, a whole host of birds, invertebrates, those kinds of things.
And they were mainly attracted by the salt and the sulfur in the water, is that right?
Yes.
So the majority of the animals that we find the remains of, both more recently in the last couple of hundred years to 10, 12, even 20,000 years ago, potentially at Big Bone, are herbivores. So they only eat plants, and there's an essential nutrient for life, and that is salt. And actually, salt is at the base of the entire story of Big Bone. But if you are a mammoth or a mastodon or even a white-tailed deer today, you have to find salt somewhere other than the food that you eat, because it does not exist. So a salt spring, or salt lick, as it has known to become, or become known as, is an ideal location for that. And so that's why the animals were drawn to Big Bone Lick. We don't have a lot of evidence on site of any type of predatory species in terms of large mammals. But we're pretty comfortable making the assumption they were in the area because they're found not too far away, but not at the physical site of Big Bone. So,
and to some extent, were they forced there by the ice sheets?
They sort of migrated down as the ice sheets came down. The end of the last ice age was actually the end of a relatively short ice age period, or a glaciation. There were three major waves of glaciers throughout this approximately two million year period, of which we focus on the very tail end, last 10 to 20,000 years. And so, yes, in some ways, the animals moved as those ice sheets expanded and contracted north and south.
One of the really neat things about the Pleistocene in North America in general is that because there was going to be a huge advancing ice sheet, paleo communities of different animals and plants that we see today had to mix up together to form new communities that we don't see anywhere on Earth right now. And that these form new environments and new opportunities for organisms and animals and plants to create new faunas, which Big Bone Lick highlights as one of the major Pleistocene sites in North America.
And Sarah, that goes, see, I never realized that. That goes back to what you were saying about this being a very significant and unique site in North America.
And what's special about it is that that showed up to, you know, scientists of the 18th and 19th centuries, or curious individuals who wanted to get to the bottom of something, which is really the basis of those early scientific discoverers at Big Bone. They're people who are effectively, I don't know, Renaissance people. They're very interested in a lot of different facets of what they think is important information that somebody of the day should know. And they wanted to get to the bottom of it by basically conducting controlled experiments.
How was the site first discovered in 1739? How did that come about?
It was discovered by the French coming in from Canada, I believe it was, that were doing excursions into the area and meeting up with the Chickasaw Indians. And they came to this region during what was going to be a meeting with the Chickasaw and discovered these bones popping out of the ground. That started excavations, and in 1740, the first bones by Baron Charles Longueuil were sent to the Cabinet of Curiosities in Paris from Big Bone Lick. And that kind of got the ball rolling in terms of this recognition that there's some really big bones of unknown origin coming out of this part of the United States.
And was this area a big hunting ground for the Native Americans who lived there at the time?
Yeah, we do have, of course, one of the great significance of Big Bone Lick is that we have human occupation and utilization of Big Bones for the last about 13,000 or so approximate years with the first Clovis points, all the way through to a recent excavation we did in 2008 that showed bison kill butchering sites 600 years ago. Mm. And so various Ford ancients, Paleo Indians, woodland peoples have all occupied the site at various times in the last 10,000 years or so.
Does anyone know when it was first called Big Bone Lick?
Yes.
Asana.
Good one, Asana.
I had 4 very long months to look at maps and read books about Big Bone and the sort of history of Northern Kentucky. So in 1841, anyway, in the 1840s, a man made a map, and it was the first time that Big Bone was sort of written down on a map. And for a long time, it was known as the place of elephant bones, or as Big Bone Lick, or the place where big bones are found. Obviously, it's still known as Big Bone today. And at one point in the late 1800s, there was even a sort of a small town called Big Bone. We on the park are lucky enough to have a remnant of that, our 1888 Big Bone Methodist Church. But anyway, I wanted to mention also that in more recent times, the last couple of hundred years, Northern Kentucky overall, for any Native American culture, kind of in the whole mid-Atlantic, almost Midwestern area, was sort of this sacred hunting ground. And so all sorts of tribes and groups would come to Northern Kentucky, Big Bone being one of those places, to make salt and to hunt. And it was sort of, you couldn't pick a fight with anyone in that area. It was considered sacred. And so even though we do find human occupation, it's not permanent. It's very temporal. It's very seasonal. And that is also important because all the way up until probably the Europeans got there, no one was living at Big Bone, or really the Northern Kentucky area south of the river, let's say, year round.
And Lewis and Clark stopped there, didn't they, on their exploration?
They did. Meriwether Lewis was there on his way to meet William Clark at the Falls of the Ohio in Louisville. William Clark was from Louisville. Meriwether Lewis was from my home state of Virginia. And he stopped there on the way. And then after their trip, Lewis and Clark sort of came back to rest and recover with Clark's family in Louisville. And not long after that, Thomas Jefferson, who was at the time the third president of the United States, I like to quiz my school groups on that, asked William Clark, along with his brother George Rogers Clark, to meet up with a man named William Goforth, who was a native of Cincinnati and had been interested in Big Bone for a long time, and conduct what we now consider the first vertebrate paleontological expedition in America.
And that was, what, 1807? Okay.
Yeah. Three weeks, about 300 bones. And to finish the bones' journey, they ended up in a room in the White House where Jefferson and his friend, sort of eminent anatomist, Dr. Wistar, could peruse and study them at their leisure, which are the sort of interpretive magic words that I get to use a lot. And Jefferson had actually had an interest in Big Bone going back probably at least 2 decades before that.
Right. Jefferson got hooked into a Big Bone Lick through Benjamin Franklin, right, who had received the first tooth in 1751 from Colonel Christopher Gist, who had been out there doing some excavations. And Benjamin Franklin and the American Philosophical Society got William Croghan to go back and collect some specimens and send them back to Benjamin Franklin, who at the time was a lobbyist living in London. And so Benjamin Franklin was really one of the first people, naturalists, scientists of his day, to actually interpret what these bones might have meant. And he figured that these were from some ancient beasts that lived at a very different time of climate than we have today in North America, and was one of the first to advocate for the fact that climates change and that organisms go extinct, which were two concepts, scientific concepts, that had not really been introduced yet, along with evolution. So it's a very, very different time period in terms of scientific thought. Well, many, many excavations, hot debates from the Royal Society of London heated up the notoriety of these bones. And word got back to Thomas Jefferson, who at the time was the president of the American Philosophical Society here in the United States, that there were these really awesome things coming up that nobody knew what they were. And so he sent Lewis to go and visit, to take a look at Dr. Goforth's collection. And Lewis went and wrote back to Thomas Jefferson in a very nice long letter about looking at the bones and tried to send some specimens back to him that he had collected, but unfortunately they were sunk in the lower Mississippi River.
Mm. We will continue our conversation about Big Bone Lick, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guests this afternoon are paleontologist Dr. Brenda Hunda, curator of invertebrate paleontology at the Cincinnati Museum Center, Sarah Lima, exhibits business development manager for the Museum Center, and Big Bone Lick Park interpreter Osana Wolf. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sarah, tell us some more about the revitalization work that's going on at Big Bone Lick. This is going to be really incredible when it gets finished, isn't it?
It really is. And we're just thrilled to be able to be a part of it. We have such a strong team in the curatorial department at Cincinnati Museum Center, and they are so passionate about telling Big Bone Lick's story. We have kind of a relationship with the site already because Cincinnati Museum Center's Geyer Center does serve as, in some instances, a repository for finds from Big Bone Lick State Historic Site. So there are many people on our staff who are very familiar with the site significance. And then Big Bone Lick itself just had quite a bit of material that was uncovered at the site already and was on display, but just wasn't being displayed in a way that really gave you, I mean, really the middle ground that Osana's been talking about, that why does this matter? Why is it important? And really, what relationship does it have to our human history and our geological history? So we were able to, just by using the finds from the site and by using some finds from our collection, just relate that story in a more vivid narrative that really gives that place a sense of importance and helps people to feel that pride in all of this happening in their backyard.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Brenda, this site was also the pioneers used it as a source of salt for several years, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I'm going to actually let Osana handle that one. That's more historical.
Okay.
Than my deep time roots.
Yeah. So I would say the most famous of all of them, once people had sort of started settling down in Kentucky, because at the time of the middle of the 1700s, Kentucky was essentially the Wild West. Even southwestern Virginia was the Wild West to a certain extent. It was not necessarily a safe place. Whether that was from the nature or the elements or the Native Americans, the Indians, the Shawnee, the other kind of people who were already living in that area. So you were taking a risk moving there, settling there. Mary Draper Ingalls, or Mary Ingalls as she was known at the time, was one of these people, along with a dozen or two dozen other people who settled in southwestern Virginia in an area just outside of, well, in Blacksburg, Virginia. It's actually on the Virginia Tech campus right now. It's called Draper's Meadow. And for a number of reasons, they were sort of attacked by a group of Shawnee. And Mary Ingalls, her two sons, and a couple of other people were taken captive. And one of the things that the Shawnee often did with their captives after taking them to Lower Shawnee Town was to take them over to Big Bone to make salt. And so for this reason, Mary Draper Ingalls is often considered the first white woman in Kentucky. That may or may not be true, but we certainly know she's the most famous first white woman in Kentucky. And we actually have an event to celebrate the 260th anniversary of this this year on July 18th at the park. But the reason Big Bone is important in her story is that is where she made her escape. She traded tomahawks with a French soldier who was sitting on a giant bone. So we can assume if he was sitting on a bone, cracking walnuts with his tomahawk, that it was quite large. And she and a woman who was German or Dutch, depending on what story you read, made their escape from Big Bone. And they walked. She eventually made it back to Draper's Meadow. 42 days they walked. And, you know, for a Shawnee, the area that they walked through would have been like walking through a Walmart. I mean, anything and everything they could have ever wanted to eat or use would have been available to them. But we can imagine that for Mary Ingalls and her companion, it was considerably more difficult for them. And so it was quite a trial and quite a triumph for her to eventually make it back. And she did. She eventually recovered one of her sons, and one of her sons died in captivity. But she is sort of the quintessential female heroine of the story of Big Bone, and sort of the story of the colonization of the wild, wild Kentucky West.
So we had salt production going there on there for a few years, and then they switched to health spas. Was that the sequence?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's interesting. A health spa there?
Yeah, so I get to use some more cool words here. By the late 1700s, early 1800s, Big Bone Lick had become a health spa and health resort. There were several doctors who lived on the premises. They had hotels. They had health spas. All of the best families of Kentucky, and I describe this as if you have a county named after you, your family probably came to Big Bone at some point to taste and loiter the waters. Salt water, as we know from the ocean and other sources, has a mildly medicinal property. And at Big Bone, we had salt sulfur springs, which we still do. I don't know if everyone knows, but sulfur smells like rotten eggs. So these people, given the fewer medical options, were able to take a rest and relaxation at Big Bone and enjoy the sulfurous, rotten egg smelling salt water. There was also a
brief. If it stinks, it has to be good.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I don't know about you, but in wetlands, like, sulfur is good. It means it's healthy. Anyway, so I'm always like, yay. And it's enjoyable for me to watch the little kids go, what is that?
As a little kid, I can remember driving that stretch of Boone County on the interstate. And when you would pass by the site, you could take a deep breath and still smell the sulfur.
Yeah. One of our, the woman who runs our gift store, she is a local of Union, Kentucky and Boone County. And boy, does she love it. But she has a lot of really interesting stories, like going to church in the early 70s. And they had to go at like 6 or 7 in the morning because in July, with humidity, the spring right behind the church, which eventually got plugged up. But anyway, the spring right behind the church, I can only imagine it was quite a sight to behold or smell to
an
behold.
Aroma.
Yeah. But anyway, to finish up the sort of story of the health spa, they actually tried to bottle and sell the water from Big Bone. I don't think that worked very well.
Didn't go very well.
I don't think so, no. and for a brief period, very brief period, from 1810 to 1812, they actually had a commercial salt works at Big Bone. And this is really important for all Cincinnatians, because what is the sort of animal mascot of Cincinnati? Anyone want to answer that question?
The pigs.
The pig. And during that time, the biggest import from Cincinnati was actually salted meat, like 90% of which was pork. And often most of the salt came from Kentucky. Big Bone attempted to be one of those places, but it turned out not to be very economically feasible. And so after 2 years, they shut their doors to the commercial salt making, but the people still came there to make salt.
Let's talk with Brenda in Boone County. Hi, Brenda.
Hello, I was calling because I have a real connection to Boone County history. My relatives went from Virginia to what is now Petersburg in the late 1600s. He was the first settler in Boone County, and that was Johannes Tanner. And Petersburg used to be Tanner's Creek or Tanner's Station. And so there's a real connection there going way back. And on that's my father's side. On my mother's side, the Fennells, the story goes in our family that one of the Fennells found a large fossil, sold it to a man who took it to New Orleans, and from there made its way to Europe. And he didn't charge that much for it, so there was nobody getting rich.
Didn't get rich quick off of that, eh?
No, and I grew up going to the park and had friends who lived right across the street from the park. And our families go way back, the Weavers and the Fennells.
Thank you, Brenda, for the call. We appreciate it.
I think that's one of the magical and amazing things about Big Bone Lick State Historic Site, is that there's a connection there for everybody. Whether you want to make a connection through personal family roots, whether you want to make a connection through science and history and your love of those two subjects, whether they go back 100 years, 1,000 years, 20,000 years, all of those connections have a place and a root. deep in the ground at Big Bone Lake State Historic Park. And that's the story that we're trying to tell. But it just makes me so happy to hear that people have those personal connections to a place like this. That's why it makes it so special. And not just anywhere in America, it makes it in our backyard, in our place.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, how long before the new center is going to be open?
Well, the interpretive center is open now, and we have phase one of that project completed. So that was to redisplay the objects in the cases, and I was talking a bit about that before, redisplaying some items that were already at Big Bone Lake State Historic Site and some items from Cincinnati Museum Center's collection as well, and really putting that together to tell that narrative. But we do have two other phases that the Friends of Big Bone Lake are currently fundraising for. And in those two phases, they're seeking to put in a Harlan's Ground Sloth holotype, which is a larger version of the sloth that you see today. Really impressive and quite a unique. It's a species that was first discovered at Big Bone Lake State Historic Site. Just quite large, taller than a standing.
Osana.
Yeah, taller than Osana, who's
like
six feet.
That's pretty tall, yeah.
8 feet tall.
Osana's 6'1".
All right.
There you go. Just to clarify.
And then we're also going to be putting in a bison antiquus diorama that will make a link between the modern bison that are on site, and trying to explain to the public, you know, what is the relationship between those bison and bison antiquus, which was another species that was it first discovered at Big Bone, Brenda?
I'm not sure. They were pretty widespread over North America at one point in time.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if they were first discovered there.
But, yeah.
Sarah, Brenda, and Osana, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having us.
From the Cincinnati Museum Center, paleontologist Dr. Brenda Hunda, curator of invertebrate paleontology, and Sarah Lima, exhibits business development manager and Big Bone Lake Park interpreter, Osama Wolf. Coming up, we'll also take a look at Red Bike and in Focus on Technology, how tech savvy is your pet. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.